So you're listening to the Taylor Report, and we have other matters, and we're very happy to say we have a guest, an experienced trade unionist who's been engaged with the issue of COVID-19, the issue of job loss, the closing of plants, General Motors, Oshawa plant. It's Tony Leah. He's with Green Jobs Oshawa. Tony, welcome to the show.
Hi, Phil.
I have to take advantage of your expertise in not just the situation of your own union, Unifor, and industry, auto, but we have with COVID-19 and the economic problems that faced by Canadian workers, shared in, by the way, we can say we have an international crisis for labor, for people who sell their work to make a living, to survive. We have labor movements. They're always called movements. I don't know why that word is added. We have the Canadian Labor Congress, the Ontario Federation of Labor. They have not been meeting, to my understanding. What is the situation with the major labor bodies of Canada?
You're right that it's very difficult to meet these days. The Canadian Labor Congress was due to have their convention and elections in May, and that's been postponed indefinitely, so we don't know when that's going to happen. One of the unhappy results of that is that the current president of the CLC, Hassan Youssef, I guess gets to just continue without any input, any democratic input from the affiliates, from the different constituent unions and their members, because he was not going to be running for re-election, but he gets to carry on. And given the fact that there's been a real lack of leadership shown by the Canadian Labor Congress under Brother Youssef, I think that's very unfortunate.
Yes, I'm going to ask you about the timing. It's almost like this interruption is of the economy and the health crisis is erased, or at least caused issues to be forgotten about. Mr. Youssef cannot continue. Partly because of his own problems he had been once a member of Unifor. Then he was the Canadian Labor Congress president, and Unifor left the Canadian Labor Congress while he was sitting as president of the CLC. So the Labor Congress inherited a headache, and we assumed they were going to resolve it this early this spring. I guess it was March they were scheduled to meet, I think, in Montreal. So remind us what the problem is with Mr. Youssef.
It is kind of remarkable. Of course, the issue should never have been allowed to continue. When Unifor unilaterally withdrew from the Canadian Labor Congress, and they did that not out of any union principle or working class principle. They did it because they wanted to undertake further raiding against other affiliates of the Congress to try to add members to Unifor ranks. And as soon as they did that, Hassan Youssef was no longer entitled to be president of the Canadian Labor Congress. And this happened well over a year ago, January of 2019.
He had what you could call a conflict. But
he had a huge conflict.
People were calling him out for that, that how could he be sitting there, and he inherits certain loyalties, or at least there's a perception of loyalties.
Well, of course there's loyalty. He's an employee of Unifor. He's a staff representative of Unifor with a very handsome pension that he's earning credits towards while he's president of the CLC. And he knows that his employer is Jerry Dias, the national president of Unifor. And he was elected as president of the CLC as a member of Unifor. And when Unifor is no longer part of the Canadian Labour Congress, there's no shred of legitimacy in Hassan Youssef continuing. And he played this little sleight of hand, which is quite remarkable. He went to another union and said, can you give me a membership card in your union? And they accommodated him. And then he said, well, I can continue because I now have a membership card from another union that he had never been a member of before, that he had never worked as a member of. You know, and he's been able to carry on, unfortunately, with very little legitimacy, you know, as a very lame duck president, and exercising no leadership or ability to inspire workers and the labor movement to take on the battles that we need to be facing right now. And in fact, he's following the political line of his union leadership, Unifor's union leadership, which is to be cozy with the Liberal Party, federally and provincially, and of course, in his case, primarily federally. So he will never challenge the Liberal government of Justin Trudeau. And he's always, you know, kind of sneaking around trying to find ways to pat them on the back, but certainly not to represent workers in confronting them.
Yeah. We're speaking to Tony Lee of Green Jobs Oshawa, Unifor. Tony, we should remind our listeners, of course, you went through the episode of the closing of the General Motors plant. Premier Doug Ford was asked if he could do something, and he said, I think the ship has sailed or some such thing. But your local members didn't accept that and has been waging a fight. If you could just remind us, partly the crisis with COVID, but also the rank and file action of Green Jobs Oshawa brought about some changes.
Well, that's right. And if we think back a couple of years ago now, when General Motors announced that they were going to close 5 plants across the United States and Canada, they announced that because they felt that they were going to enhance the profits of their owners by doing that. They don't have any concern whatsoever for workers who are displaced in Oshawa or the other plants. They don't care about the communities that they have profited from. In Oshawa's case, for over 100 years, GM has been making profits in Oshawa. They are able to act with total disdain to the governments of Ontario and Canada, which gave them $11 billion a few years ago because they said they were on the brink of bankruptcy. And they took that money, they returned to profitability the next year, and they've been making record profits ever since, without the slightest sense that they have any obligation to our communities. So it was a real slap in the face when they announced the closure. And unfortunately, we operate in a political system in which corporations are deemed to be beyond criticism and beyond control. They get to set the ground rules. And somebody like Doug Ford, who's supposed to be the premier of this province, you would think would represent the citizens of this province, but he doesn't. He says to GM, you want to leave? Well, you know, I guess you have the right to do that. You know, goodbye. And waved his hat as the ship left the dock, as he said. And the federal government was no better. They're not, they're slightly better spoken than Doug Ford, Justin Trudeau is, but he didn't do anything different. He never once said to General Motors, you're wrong to do that. He said, well, maybe we can find some way of helping the workers that, you know, have been made to walk the plank as GM leaves the dot. But stand in their way, criticize them? No, he wouldn't do that. And we are in the, we're left in the awkward position of being members of a union that's supposed to also represent us. And the leader of the union is also unwilling to challenge or criticize either the prime minister of the country or his government when they don't act to protect the workers in Oshawa.
I have a vivid memory of your leader, Jerry Dias, saying, well, I'm going to call the prime minister. And the big idea was that he's the one labor leader who, because of his tendency to support the Liberal Party, could show his members, I can pick up the phone and I'll get mad at him or I will tell him directly. But then nothing happened after that phone call either. If it went through, I don't even remember now whether there was an acknowledged call, but the idea was that, you know, see, we have friends in power. It turned out the friend in power doesn't return calls, I guess.
There was a period of radio silence. We heard from Jerry that he was going to call Justin, and then for several days after that, we never heard what the result was. It's not surprising, really, if you have already committed yourself to supporting that government, then you really have no more leverage with them, and you're at their mercy. And whatever they do, you have to try to find some way of excusing it or not criticizing it. And that's where we ended up. And instead, Jerry Dias decided that the enemy was the production of vehicles in Mexico, which is another way of saying that he made workers in Mexico the enemy instead of making General Motors, the corporation, the enemy. And he tried to convince people for the next several months that they should not buy vehicles assembled in Mexico, and that would be way of protecting the workers in Oshawa. And it was, as I think most people would have expected, a miserable failure of a strategy.
Well, it was also quite embarrassing in many ways, because it was, my memory is, didn't they buy a Super Bowl ad or something? But to be seen to be against the interests of workers in a totally different economy. And that is living out an alliance with to put it in class terms, you're siding with your own capitalist class against the workers of another country. And by the way, I think people intuitively see that. I mean, it has a funny odor. People don't have to be trained in the union movement to say, that doesn't seem right. I mean, after all, by the way, many, our agriculture, you could say, is dependent on Mexican workers. And where is the respect? Instead, it was made adversarial, a very unhappy situation. But by the way, that ties in nicely, I believe, with a theme that we need to strike, particularly in the time of COVID-19. We are experiencing an actual pandemic, where every country, all members of the World Health Organization, of course, without Donald Trump, who's taken his 2 cents and gone home, but everybody else says, yes, it's a common enemy. And frankly, for working people around the globe, we have a bunch of things we need to be talking about in order to fight the virus, but also to improve our health and our own economies. But it has to start with recognition and respect. This raises two names for me. Sid Ryan, former leader of the Ontario Federation of Labor, and a really outstanding, certainly one of the most important figures in the Canadian labor movement. And a second name, Dimitri Lascaris, who's now seeking the leadership of the Green Party. These individuals are talking about matters that are outside the borders of Canada, about alliances or respect for international law. I think I have in mind Venezuela, where both Dimitri Lascaris and Sid Ryan have spoken up. The Middle East, where the Palestinians tend to be neglected, putting it mildly, by Canadian media and Canadian politicians. You want to talk about this? And Sid Ryan on his Facebook has said very positive things about Dimitri. What about this the appeal that Dimitri represents, and why Sid Ryan, major labor leader, known, of course, for running for the NDP, associated with the NDP, but who's been rather frustrated. This is a long intro to a subject here, but Sid seems to think it's important that Dimitri Lascaris do well. What's your knowledge of Dimitri Lascaris, and what do you think of the way Sid Ryan has been framing the discussion?
Well, I'd like to start by going back a year. And one of the major accomplishments of Green Jobs Oshawa is that we identified over a year ago that the real answer to GM pulling out of Oshawa is that it should be nationalized, and that productive capacity and equipment and technology, and especially the workers, the thousands of workers there, be used to produce what's needed by our communities, like electric fleet vehicles for Canada Post and other government purposes. And when we launched that campaign in April in 2019, two people were at that meeting. And you've just mentioned both of them, Sid Ryan and Dimitri Lascaris, supporting our call as the right way to build a working class movement that had a chance to achieve something positive. So they have been by our side in our fight from the beginning. And I think that says something important about their instincts and their principles as political leaders. Dimitri Lascaris, more recently, has launched a campaign to be the national leader of the Green Party. And if you look at his political platform, you find a lot to get really excited about. In terms of what is needed to confront the climate crisis globally, one of the major global challenges facing all of us, what is needed to improve the lives of workers in this country, the vast majority of our country, of course, as every country, are workers. And he identifies the problems that workers are facing and has very important proposals that would be galvanizing in building a working class movement if he became the leader of the Green Party, demanding $20 an hour as a minimum wage federally, and with concrete proposals about how that could be used to achieve the same in provincial jurisdictions. He's calling for reduced working time for workers at this equivalent level of pay. And that's, if you think about it, it was a major demand of the labor movement during the Depression in the 1930s, and really moved the working class movement forward, and has been largely forgotten or buried for decades. And he's reviving it. He's saying that, you know, as a leader of the Green Party, that he would be a leader who would confront the corporations. So he wouldn't be like Doug Ford or Justin Trudeau saying to GM, "Oh, you're leaving. Oh, that's, oh dear. Well, we'll try and help the workers that you've." No. He's saying he's going to take on the corporations if they treat us like that.
He's comfortable with words like nationalization.
Yes.
Saying, look, we have the workers, we have the plant, it belongs to us. we have a responsibility to the people of Canada. And he doesn't put a bunch of apologies and 10 other possible choices. He's prepared to protect those jobs and also to build a Canadian industry.
Yes. Yeah, a lot of his platform is based around the idea of planning, which includes citizens and workers. He calls it democratic planning from the bottom up. But planning is critical, and that's one of the major flaws and failings of capitalism, is that governments don't have the power and don't have the vision to plan anything because it's corporations that are making the decisions.
Yeah, look at the tragedy south of the border, by the way, our own tragedies, loss of life here to this COVID-19, and the main culprit seems to be private areas or areas deemed to be private, like elderly care here, which we are in. You must be thinking about this. People heard from the Canadian Army that they found a disaster. And everybody said, well, you know, and by the way, disaster equals crime. Deaths that should not have occurred. And two things came up, basically nationalization of elderly care. It was at least absolute security that people would be looking after the elderly would be answerable to the Canadian people through its government. That seems to be a crisis. And then south of the border, well, I should step back one step. Today, we're hearing there would be a commission and it will have secret meetings while talking about this problem. That, I think we could agree, is actually the problem. Who are these people? And do they represent money or do they represent people? Or do they represent profit? That kind of thing. And now south of the border, we have 150,000 dead Americans because they have, as they say, the freest capitalist operation in the world. But that's what it leads to. Everything, including prisons, is open to be turned into a private profit operation. Now, Dimitri, of course, and Sid, they're both steeped in the labor movement, but also socialist thinking, which, by the way, was once upon a time part of the Canadian dialogue. Discussion was, are there other systems? It's apparent now through COVID-19 that, yes, indeed, there are other systems, and the ones that perform best turn out to be socialists. And it's just I hate to embarrass them, but it is a fact that Vietnam probably has the best record. A socialist country, one that, by the way, had to lose hundreds of thousands of its own citizens in a fight to be free of a U.S. invasion. And now they have the best health care. So I guess that I'll lead it back into your thoughts on that. But also, Dimitri is a guy who knows these things and says them. And he also goes to the places where there are problems. He went to Caracas, Venezuela, when Chrystia Freeland was going to a meeting in Peru or somewhere in South America to try to overthrow the government of Venezuela. And Dimitri went to Venezuela and condemned the regime change philosophy of the Canadian and U.S. governments.
Mm-hmm. That is a critical issue that is an important part of Dimitri's campaign. He's saying that it is a tragedy that we have governments that don't have an independent foreign policy that take their cues from the United States, which is the major source of problems in the world, of invasion of other countries and the attempts to overthrow governments and basically acting like a world bully whose goal is to corral as much of the world's resources for themselves as they can. And when anybody objects, when the government of Venezuela or the government of Syria objects, they then become the targets. And sure enough, you know, the Canadian government, like a loyal little dog, is running along, yipping and yapping to the same tune and saying, oh yeah, we have to, you know, they're the bad guys. And Canada played a significant role in the Lima group in working to help the United States government in their goal to overthrow the government of Venezuela. And Dmitry has been very outspoken about that and for the need to have a different kind of foreign policy in this country. And that's an important part of his campaign for leader of the Green Party. If I could just read a sentence from Dmitry. He says that a case that really highlights the abject hypocrisy and moral bankruptcy of Canada's foreign policy is Venezuela. Our country has been leading this motley collection of Western states known as the Lima Group, whose singular objective, as far as I can tell, is to remove Maduro and the Chavista movement from power and replace them with a right-wing neoliberal government. And, you know, he mentions that Honduras and Brazil are members of the Lima Group, you know, and Honduras is led by a government which is completely illegal. And Bolsonaro in Brazil is, you know, virtually a fascist. And you know, that's who we're chumming around with and rubbing shoulders with as a country. There's something wrong with that. And it's certainly not in the interest of workers in Canada, the citizens of Canada. It's in the interest of the U.S. ruling class.
Yes.
Not in our interests. And we have to start making that distinction if we're ever going to make any progress.
Absolutely. And the other point there is that we've had these coups, like in Bolivia, and the Canadian government had no problem with that. And there was an election scheduled. And now the junta that put a phony government in power is announcing there won't be an election. They had scheduled an election, and the party of Evo Morales was clearly going to win. They were way ahead in all polls, so no, there's not going to be an election. There is no complaint from the Canadian government. Because they backed that coup, and they did it in a nice, quiet way, but helping prop it up at the same time that they're working to overthrow, visibly in front of the whole world, working to install a man named Guaido in power. Guaido was introduced to the United States Congress by the great demon in popular caricature, Donald Trump. And when Donald Trump pointed to Mr. Guaido, when he was giving his State of the Union speech, every member of Congress leaped to their feet, led by Nancy Pelosi, looking up at Guaido reverentially and clapping, applauding him. And in the Canadian Parliament, they didn't get an opportunity, of course, to stand up and applaud for Guaido, which they all would have done. I really don't know anybody but Dmitry who would say, this is terrible, this is criminal, and we should have nothing to do with Guaido and staging coups against people. So, yeah, in my opinion, it would be a wonderful thing to have a voice like that in Parliament. It would be quite different from the current leader of the Green Party, frankly, who many people had hoped would be able to play that role. But it's, we're talking about the necessity of standing strong. And in the face of U.S. power, there are not a lot of voices willing to do that. That's the impression I get.